key. The chronic administration of the drugs then caused substantial and long-lasting alterations in neurofunction. After a few weeks, the person's brain is now functioning in a manner that is both qualitatively as well as quantitatively different from the normal state. So research was showing that rather than fixing a known abnormality, showed that there was no known normality before you went on the drugs, and then the drugs actually caused your brain to begin operating in an abnormal manner. So that tells us how much we were led astray by this marketing of this new story. Just real quickly, pharmaceutical companies, of course, also wanted to expand the boundaries, make it easier for people to get diagnosed. And so, for example, when DSM-4 was created in 1994, Lisa Cosgrove looked at how many of the people on the task force had ties to pharmaceutical companies. And she did the same for DSM-5. The task force is the force that governs everything. And you'll see that 57% did in DSM-4, 69% in DSM-5. Now, in addition, the DSM, when they were creating a DSM, they have work panels for the different diagnoses. And you'll see, like in some of them, mood disorders, 100% in DSM-4 had ties to the drug company. And then 100% for schizophrenia. And what's important here is as they're going to be loosening the boundaries, this is what the, make it easier to make a diagnosis, create more diagnostic categories, and also make it easier to make a diagnosis. They're being paid by drug companies, in essence, to make it easier to make a diagnosis. You'll see that in DSM-4, we get new disorders. We now have almost 300. But more important, the diagnostic criteria for many disorders are loosened. And after 1994, after DSM-4 is published, researchers do a survey and they say, wow, 26% of American adults now suffer from a diagnosable mental disorder each year, and that 13% of youth do. That's based on these categories. It's not based on some sort of survey in Nature about what actually a mental disorder is. It's just saying they qualify for a disorder in DSM-4, which shows you how big the market now has become for psychiatric drugs, that basically one in four people can be diagnosed with a mental disorder at any time. DSM-5, we get some new disorders, also further expansion of some disorders. And just real quickly, here's how the ADHD market was built. So there was no attention deficit disorder prior in DSM-1 or DSM-2. It's first created as a discrete disorder in 1980. The cardinal symptoms said to be inattention, impulsivity, and hyperactivity. And they say it affects about 3% of children. Now in DSM-4, they say there's three subtypes: inattentive only, hyperactive, and impulsive only, and those who have both. Now you only needed one of those types, made it easier to diagnose, and disorder now said to affect 3 to 5% of all American children. After 1994, Biedermann, who was a child psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he'd been a member of the DSM-4 work panel, he begins publishing articles that state 6 to 9% of American school children have ADHD, and the stimulants provide a long-term benefit. DSM-5 further loosens the boundaries for diagnosing ADHD, and by 2016, 12% of school-age youths had been diagnosed with ADHD. And I'm just showing you here, here's the growth of ADHD in U.S. youth. And of course, this created a big market for stimulants, and pharmaceutical companies were very happy about that. And what's the payoff to Joseph Biedermann? He was the lead guy in helping build this market. Over a period of 15 years, he received speakers' fees, consulting fees, and research funding from more than 24 pharmaceutical companies, including three that made three popular ADHD drugs. Just one of these companies paid him $1.6 million during this time. So you see that academic psychiatrists who help build markets, who help convince the public that these are discrete disorders that need drug treatment, they're going to be paid handsomely by the drug companies for creating this. I'm going to get a little bit behind here, although I'm not really too bad. I just want to show you how this now affects what we're told about the efficacy of drugs. So Xanax is going to be the first drug tested for psychiatric disorder after the publication of DSM-3. And we're going to learn, and panic disorder was, it was created as a separate diagnosis in 1980. Before, it had just been part of an anxiety diagnosis. And here's what they reported, that after 4 weeks, the drug provided a statistically significant benefit in terms of reduction of panic attacks each week. And you'll see, although placebo got better, Xanax had a greater reduction of panic attacks. And this is the finding that's going to be reported in, emphasized in research journals and promoted to the prescribing public and to the public. But this was not a four-week study. This actually had two endpoints. The first one was 8 weeks. That was the period of active treatment. And you'll see at the end of 8 weeks, there was no difference, no statistically significant difference in panic attacks between placebo and the Xanax group. And then, because benzodiazepines were known to be addictive, the study had to have a withdrawal phase when people who were either going to be withdrawn from placebo, if they're in the placebo group, or they're going to be withdrawn from Xanax if they've been randomized to Xanax. And look what happens to the Xanax patients randomized to Xanax when they were withdrawn. They get much, much worse. They have a rebound, episodes of panic. You'll see they're now worse off than they were at baseline. And I forget the number, but a high percentage were unable to get off, like something like 40%. So the data actually tells you of a drug that's going to lose its effectiveness at 8 weeks, and then it's going to be very tough to get off, and that when you come off, you're going to be having worse panic attacks than you had even in the beginning at baseline, and much, much worse than the placebo group. So you see right away that what's going to happen with this merger, with the guild wanting to promote drugs and the pharmaceutical industry wanting to promote drugs, they're going to be very selective in data and findings that are promoted to the public. Now, here's the STAR-D study. It was done in the early 2000s, and it was touted by, it was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. It was touted as the largest and longest study ever done to evaluate depression treatment. And the reason they did it, they said this: those drug industry trials are conducted in a select group of patients, and they use inclusion criteria that exclusion criteria that eliminates most people with depression, most real world patients. So they said, we're going to conduct a study in real world patients to see how well antidepressants work. It's not going to be placebo control. The way the study is going to be designed is they're going to, people with moderate depression, a score of 14 or above on the HAM-D, are going to be treated with an antidepressant. And if they don't get better after 12 weeks, then they'll be treated with a different antidepressant, maybe psychotherapy. And if they don't get better after the second try, they can have a third try with a different combination of drugs. And they'll be given four tries to have a moment when they remit, when they, all of a sudden their depression is gone. And then when they remit, they'll be put into a year-long follow-up trial to see if they stay well. Now, in 2006, the STAR-D investigators announced the good news. Over the course of all four levels, after four treatments, almost 70% of those who didn't withdraw from the study became symptom-free. They just got completely better. And this was the message that was promoted to the public, to doctors, to prescribers. And the message became this: if the first drug doesn't work, try a second. If that doesn't, try a third. If that doesn't, try a fourth or a combination. And eventually, 70% of people will just get fully better. And this became the governing information, the governing evidence base for prescribers for the next 16, 17 years. And newspapers regularly touted this finding as evidence of the efficacy of antidepressants. And you'll see this. 2022, by the end of the STAR-D study, half of the participants had significantly improved after using either the first or second medication, and nearly 70% had become symptom-free by the fourth antidepressant. Now, actually, as early as 2010, there was a psychologist named Ed Piggott who published a paper showing that there had been various protocol reviews to inflate those results, and that the actual results were closer to this. There were 4,041 who enrolled. Only 1,518 remitted. That's 38%. Of the 1,518 that were then went into the year-long trial to see if they could stay well, and doctors could change their prescriptions, they could change the doses, Only 108 were still well at the end of 1 year. The remaining 3,933 had either never remitted, relapsed, or dropped out. That's a stay well rate at the end of 1 year of 3%. Yet the public is being told 70%. Now, this past August, Piggott and his colleagues, they got access to the patient level data, and they said the actual remission rate was only 35%, not 38%. And they documented very closely all the ways that the researchers violated the protocol, including counting people who weren't even depressed at the beginning of this, the study, to dramatically inflate their outcomes. Now, it was funded by the NIMH. However, the people who did this trial did work for numerous pharmaceutical companies. August Rush was the lead investigator. He had 17 ties to the makers of psychiatric drugs. Another big one was M. Trivedi. He had 21. Another one was Maurizio Fava. He had 39 ties. So even though it's not funded by the drug companies, these people had were being paid, in essence, to maintain societal belief in antidepressants as a first-line therapy. And of course, their guild wanted them to do this as well. And so what do we see happened? They in essence, told us a false result. They doubled the actual remission rate, and they hid the fact that only 108, 3% were well at the end of 1 year. There was a table that published that, but they never discussed it. Now, real quickly, we have had other NIMH studies designed to see how do these drug treatments work in real-world patients and over longer periods of time. The long study was of ADHD was called the MTA study of ADHD. When they mounted this, they said, this will be the first well-controlled study of stimulants for ADHD, and it should guide our care of use of stimulants in children. And here's the result that was promoted to the public. At the end of 14 months, youth treated with a stimulant had a greater reduction in ADHD symptoms than those treated with behavioral therapy. They also performed slightly better on reading tests. Researchers concluded, since ADHD is now regarded by most experts as a chronic disorder, ongoing treatment often seems necessary. What your public wasn't told this, but if you read the follow-up players closely, you find that at the end of 3 years, medication use was a significant marker, not of benefit, but of deterioration. Medicated children were also slightly smaller and higher delinquency and had higher delinquency scores. At the end of 6 years, medication use was associated with worse hyperactivity, impulsivity, and oppositional defiant disorder symptoms, and with greater overall functional impairment. I guarantee you, you did not see that. You weren't told this by your, if you had a child who was seen as having ADHD, you were not told about these 3 years and 6 year results. They weren't promoted by psychiatry to the public. They weren't promoted to prescribers. They weren't in the textbooks. You had to read, and they weren't even in the abstracts. You had to read the 3 year report and the 6 year report real closely to see that there was this worse outcomes for the medicated children. And once again, I just looked at the investigators on this study and the ties they had to pharmaceutical companies. And you'll see they had many ties, including being on speakers bureaus and serving as consultants. So of course, that gives them a reason, a motivation to protect the use of stimulants as a first-line treatment for ADHD. One more such study. This is the TAD study, Treatment of Adolescent Depression study, that was mounted when their black box warning was put on antidepressants, saying they increased the suicide risk for those who were young. And what they reported in this study was that that wasn't true. There was no excess suicidal risk. So the way the study was done, people either randomized to placebo or CBT or Prozac or Prozac plus CBT. And if you look at the total at the end of 9 months, suicidal ideation was 10 in the non-drug group, 9 in the suicidal attempts in the non-drug group, fluoxetine 16 suicidal ideation, 9 in the suicidal attempts. And they concluded there is no evidence of medication-induced behavioral activation as a precursor to a suicidal event. This conclusion was what gave the green light for child psychiatrists and others to begin prescribing antidepressants to youth again, because they said this NIMH study had in fact not found they increased the risk of suicide. But then if you read the study closely, here's what you find. And this is what I did. Those randomized to placebo after 12 weeks, many were random, were then put on the drug. Not all of them, but some of them. Same with the CBT group. After 12 weeks, some were put on drug. So there was a table in the publication that showed whether the person was on drug when they suffered suicidal ideation or suicidal attempts. And here's what you find. During the first 12 weeks, when the non-drug group, in fact, was only on placebo or CBT, there were 7 had suicidal ideation and 1 suicide attempts. Those who stayed off for the next 24 weeks, they had no more suicidal ideation, no more suicidal attempts. So there was a total of 7 suicidal ideations and 1 suicidal attempt in the non-drug group. But now you have randomized to placebo, but switched to fluoxetine at 12 weeks. And what do you see? You see 3 suicidal ideation and 6 suicidal attempts in that group. Then you have randomized to CBT, but then switched to fluoxetine at 12 to 36 weeks. You see also suicidal attempts. So the bottom line was this. The total people who had suicidal ideation, 7 were on not drugs, 19 were on drugs, but most important, suicidal attempts. There was only 1 in someone not exposed to the drugs, antidepressants, 17 among those who exposed to drugs. So they hid the fact that nearly all suicide attempts occurred in drug people taking fluoxetine, and instead said, by hiding this fact, that they randomized to placebo, switched to drug. Those in their own study, they assigned that suicidal attempt to placebo. That's how the sort of misdirection happened. So what we see here is, again, a betrayal of the public. The study actually showed it was the kids on fluoxetine that had the suicidal attempts, and yet they hid that and instead said there was no difference. This led to suicide. This led to increased use of antidepressants. And we have now had almost 20 years of rising suicide rates among our youth since prescribing of antidepressants became common to youth and seen as not problematic. And again, once again, basically the investigators had ties to Eli Lilly, which is the maker of fluoxetine, and they received honorariums, resupports, consulting contracts, and served on the speakers' bureaus. Okay, there was another NIMH study before this STAR*D study, and they said, well, we don't know what the course of untreated depression is. So we're going to have to figure out, does treated depression, meaning treated with antidepressants, or actually probably psychotherapy, do they do better than untreated? And here's what they found at the end of 6 years, that 32% of those treated had a cessation of role function. In other words, they stopped working or whatever their role was in life, versus 10% of those untreated and became incapacitated on disability. It was 7 times higher for those who were treated. So here you see, once again, you never hear about this, but you see the natural course of depression in this study has a milder long-term course than those who are treated. This is the best long-term study that's been done of schizophrenia patients. So I'll get more into it in the second half of this presentation. But you'll see that the recovery rate for those off antipsychotics who took themselves off beginning at 2 years was 8 times higher than those on drugs. Have you heard about that? Well, if you've read Anatomy of an Epidemic, or if you've gone to Mad America, you have. But this finding was not promoted to the public.